The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Gina Menzies is with me, the theologian. Gina, this is a conversation that would get us locked up, I think, back in Tudor England to contemplate the passing of the monarch. It was a treasonable act. But nevertheless, how is a new pope chosen? Or before even that process starts, what happens when a pope passes away? What's the process
that kicks into gear? I would like to say the news from Rome is better.
Yeah, he worked today, as Eamon said.
I do think Francis has such a strong will to live, to finish, if you like, his agenda. And his agenda really particularly goes to October, when the final kind of round of the Synod meetings take place. And I think that is, he desires that so strongly. And it's great to hear. And in a way, it's I don't want to talk about his passing, but I am happy to
talk about it in an abstract sense.
Yes, what happens when a pope dies. When a pope dies, a person called the Carmelengo is the chamberlain. So he is the one who confirms his death. Obviously, in the past, it used to be a tap on the forehead with the silver spoon and calling his name. But I mean, science obviously has taken over. So medically, he's pronounced dead. And the chamberlain, as such, he announces his death. He tells all the Roman officials. He immediately seals the apartment of the Pope. And the other interesting thing is he takes the signet ring of the Pope, which is like a signature, and that is destroyed, because every pope has their own signet ring that is like their seal on documents, etc., etc. So that's destroyed. The Vatican then goes into 9 days of official mourning. Mm-hmm. The funeral takes place approximately a week after that. The pope is usually laid out in his white vestments in the basilica, where people come to pay their respects to him. And only about maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, there is a conclave from the phrase conclave with a key, which, as you know, the world certainly pays attention to that, because it's like almost every election.
So that only kicks into gear a couple of weeks afterwards.
Yes. I mean, approximately between 2 to 3 weeks after the burial of a pope.
And the conclave then, lots of people listening to the show will have watched the movie recently. How accurate is it?
It's actually very accurate.
Really?
It's really very accurate. I'd actually read the book.
I haven't seen the movie.
No, I read the book, and Ralph Fiennes plays the Carmelengo, and he is superb, beyond just superb. I mean, it's unbelievable. The end of it, I will not tell you, because it has a huge twist.
It does, don't give it away.
Yeah, that isn't in the book. But other than that, it's not in the book.
Other than that,
it's very accurate. I mean, there is this sense, you know, that the Spirit speaks to all these cardinals, of whom there will be approximately 120. You have to be, if you're over 80, you're not allowed to vote. That's kind of a regulation that's been brought in. So approximately 120 cardinals. So they will be, if you like, locked into the Sistine Chapel. They have to hand over their laptops, their phones, all of the documents. And they will vote approximately four, maybe five times a day. And the one who's elected must win 2/3 of the vote to be elected.
And do they get their phones back kind of every evening when they leave, and then kind of back into the bucket on the way in every morning?
Yes, they're not kind
of under lock and key for the entire process.
I mean, the sense almost is that, you know, reach a decision or you're going to stay. I mean, that's kind of pushing it a little bit glibly. But yes, I mean, I know some Jesuits, and they have a wonderful phrase that I think does happen. I mean, I don't know this because I'm not privy to the inside, but the Jesuits, when they're electing a new leader, they talk about this phrase, the murmuratio. I think it's beautiful. And it is kind of, there will be conversations.
Okay.
And you sort of, you know that's going on. There are conversations. And the cardinals can make speeches. And, you know, certainly the last time, I think, when Francis spoke, and he had a two-way ticket. He was going back, you know, to Argentina. His speech had a profound effect on people, because he kind of set out a vision for the church. And suddenly people said, this may be the direction we should go in. And he also was, if you like, the runner-up in the previous election for Benedict. But I think he's an incredibly humble person. He really didn't think it was going to happen to him.
To people who watch it closely, are there obvious runners and riders?
There are. Now, it's very hard. Like, one of the things I think I heard you earlier on saying, under Pope Francis, there's been a vast number of newly appointed cardinals.
And yeah, somebody made that point. Now, that wasn't my insight, I should say. I did say it earlier, but someone had said it on the show last week, that lots of new cardinals from Southeast Asia or Africa, and they don't all know each other.
From all over the world, and they don't know each other. And yet, you know, I mean, people like you and I are the public, could find out a lot of information at the same time. Now, obviously, we don't know them personally, but, you know, the Secretary of State is a man called Pietro Parolin, and he's very close to Francis. Is that a possibility? He's Italian. Yes, it is. I mean, they used to always be Italians. And then, you know, it broke with JP the Second, and subsequently Benedict, who is German, and Francis, who's from Argentina, but very much of an Italian heritage. His grandparents, you know, left Italy. Then there's one that I don't, the name just keeps coming to me, a guy called Matteo Zuppi, who's also Italian. And they would both be... And I hate labels. I absolutely hate labels, but they would not be conservative. And they'd very much be in the vein of Francis, you know, an open church in dialogue with the world. They've made a lot of statements, you know, about Eucharist for people who are divorced, who are remarried, which would be absolutely no-no to the conservatives. So there are people very much in Francis, if you like, outlook of the kind of church. Yeah. And I think that's really what, you know, these men, and they are all men, will deliberate on what kind of church do we want, and therefore what kind of person would fill this role best. Now, I think that's how Francis came to be Pope. Somebody who was open to the world, was very much of the outlook of the Second Vatican Council. We're not closed in on ourselves. Yeah. We want to be inclusive. We understand diversity. And Francis, I mean, he's been very humble, and he's tried to reverse the notion of the church as a kind of a monarchical institution, really, and talked about the church in service to the world. Mm. And he talks about the world as not just to the Catholic world, but the world. And if you look at the role of the Pope, I mean, it is a fascinating mixture, because the Vatican is an independent state.
Yeah.
It's about 100 acres with about 600 people with their own coinage, their own staff, entirely independent. And because of that, the Pope, as well as having a spiritual role, has quite a political role in the world, in that they have, you know, diplomatic relations with about 180 countries, which gives them huge, you know, entree into world affairs. The Pope speaks quite well. Generally, there have been a few popes who've spoken at the UN. You know, they speak on behalf of, you know, they advocate for social justice. They advocate for human rights. They try and mediate between some of the awful kind of conflicts that are going on in the world. So they actually have a role, in a way, way beyond sort of just the church spiritual administrative role.
How much power do they wield over the institution, whether it be a kind of a more conservative or more traditionalist pope we end up with, or somebody more in the Pope Francis vein? Like, I'm sure, like any kind of institution, there are checks and balances, as we would say. I'm sure, is that true of the church as well?
Well, it is. I mean,
we're not going to have the new pope signing executive orders.
No, absolutely not. there's a few I think I'd like him to maybe sign. But anyway, no, but he does have the final word. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he does sign off on something like excommunication. If you go back, I mean, bishops can excommunicate people too. But interesting, under Francis, if you go back to the role of Benedict, and when Benedict was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, I know that's a mouthful, but they are the ones who kind of monitored what theologians said. And between when Benedict was, when he was in charge of that department, if you like, and as Pope, there were about 100 theologians who were silenced. 100, over 100. Francis has silenced nobody, because he believes in dialogue. Mm. He believes in listening. And I don't think the sort of silencing of theologians is remotely helpful to a dialogue of the church with the world. All theologians sometimes do is try and relate the gospel to the situation where they find themselves in. And sometimes, you know, they raise questions that maybe other people aren't raising.
I mean, I know it's more nuanced than this, but to what extent is the division, or is there a division in the conclave or in the kind of the broader hierarchy of the church between those traditionalists? The, you know, what would we say? The Pope Benedict view of the world versus the Pope Francis view of the world.
Well, I mean, I think there is diversity. And again, in fairness to Francis, he has appointed cardinals with whom he probably wouldn't be in total agreement, because he does believe in diversity. But I think those sharp divisions are far less than they were in the past. If you traced back, you know, the last 100 years of papal elections, there was always, it was almost like a conservative followed by a liberal followed by a conservative. Mm. And I say that disliking those labels anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, there has been a seismic change in the institution, a lot to do with clerical abuse. And if you think of some of the phrases that Francis has used, he constantly talks about, well, the servant church, he constantly talks about declericalizing the church. So a church that was kind of very inward looking, I think it is now open to the world. And it would be quite stunning if it reverted back to a sort of a pre-Vatican II kind of church. Though there are cardinals who are of that ilk, who would speak very badly about Eucharist for people who are divorced or remarried, who would be utterly opposed to LGBT. But I think they are in the minority.
And those cultural fault lines, to what extent do they correspond with geographical areas?
Well, to some extent they do. There's certainly one cardinal in the Congo whose name I've forgotten, but who would be very much of opposed to homosexuality in any form. There are some Americans that are very conservative. But there's equally, there's an American that kind of I've been reading about. And they say if you go into the conclave as one of the favourites, you never get there. So I hope I wouldn't cause any bother. Who'd be listening to me anyway? But a guy called Blaise Supich, who's of Chicago, who's incredibly open-minded, very, very much like, and he's not afraid to speak out. Mm. He believes the Eucharist should be available to everybody who comes forward. And he believes the church should drop this appalling language and it has dropped it, but maybe hasn't made an official statement about LGBTQ. And, you know, is an advocate for social justice. So he seems to me my favourite at the moment, based on what I know. And, you know, the stuff I don't know, and you're absolutely right. How are they all going to know each other? But I think on the surface that might be problematic, but they will all come to the Pope's funeral, and that situation they're all able to speak to each other and get to know each other.
The murmurazzo.
And there will be, and I presume the murmurazzo, and you know, I presume like every other organisation, there will be what you might call kingmakers.
Yes.
Who are sort of say, this is the kind of person, you know, that we need. I remember reading about Francis, his recent book, Hope. He really did genuinely seem stunned. And he made a speech which was very much about a church open to the world. And he used this phrase that I really liked, that a church must be open to the peripheries. And he didn't mean just geographically. And that's what I liked about it, the peripheries of life, an existential kind of outlook. And one of the other cardinals approached him and said, you know, could we possibly have that script? And he said, well, I don't have it, but I'll kind of tell you what I said. And he seemed almost not to realise that was almost like a, we want to know what you're talking about. And, you know, that would be spread around.
Yeah.
And then he said on one other evening when he was there having their supper, they started asking him lots of questions. And on his reflection post that, he said it was almost like an examination. So that is all going on. I mean, and I know they sort of say the spirit sort of speaks, but the spirit speaks through people. Anyway, so I think the spirit does speak to cardinals, and they go about their business like any other institution.
Isn't fascinating stuff, Gina. Thanks a million for coming into us.
Pleasure.
Gina Menzies, theologian.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.